This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 28th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 214. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. The Is It Just Me commentary. And on the big deal feature, the aftermath of the mid-November storm and floods and slides. The cleanup continues in the Fraser Valley, Merritt, Princeton, the Nicola Valley, and the Coquihalla Highway. Meanwhile, Victoria, the legislature finished a six-week session, and the NDP gutted the Freedom of Information Law. Here are highlights of the week that was. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or are you tired of Justin Trudeau and John Horgan blaming climate change for the November 13th to 15th rain, flood, and landslide disaster in southern BC? November is the stormiest month on the West Coast. However unusual the fall of 2021 is, it is actually a lot like the fall of 1955. Horgan and Trudeau met in Victoria on November 26th after Trudeau toured Abbotsford and blamed climate change. Not their own failure to heed so many expert reports recommending improvements to dikes and bridges. These are two politicians who called historically expensive, unnecessary power grab snap elections during a pandemic. These are two politicians who campaigned on carbon taxes and bullet trains, rather than more mundane things like upgrading dikes and bridges to prepare for climate change. Now, BC faces a multi-billion dollar bill in the Fraser Valley, Nicola Valley, and on the Coquihalla Highway. Don't blame climate change, blame Trudeau and Horgan and those politicians that came before them. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. The cleanup continues from the mid-November storms, floods, and landslides in southern BC's state of emergency. At least four people died in the slides. Gas was rationed and supply chains interrupted. There were reports of panic buying at gas stations and grocery stores. In flooded Abbotsford, tens of thousands of chickens, turkeys, and cows also expired at Sumas Prairie Farms. The livestock death toll could rival the 600,000 poultry that died in the June heat dome. On November 25th, Agriculture Minister Lana Popham gave an update after she visited Abbotsford.
In the agriculture sector in the valley, we have about 57 blueberry producers that have been affected, about 2,100 acres of blueberries. We've got about 82 acres of raspberries that have also been impacted. Both of these types of commodities will need to be ripped out and replanted. Many of them are still underwater. We have field crops, approximately 420 acres, that were unharvested at the time of the flood, and now they are lost. This is 4,000 tons of stored and unharvested field vegetables that are most likely damaged and lost. Most of these were on the Sumas Prairie or in Fort Langley. Some farms are still able to salvage some of their crops, and we congratulate them for trying to get that food into the food supply right now. It's a tough job. But cabbage, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, carrots, and leeks have been significantly impacted. We've got two major flower growers that are under several feet of water. This is about 250,000 plants that are lost in nurseries. About 100% of bulb growers in the Sumas Flats have been impacted. We also have two land-based fish farms in the Fraser Valley that have been impacted. The losses haven't been entered yet, but we believe that all fish are presumed lost. These are tilapia and barramundi fish. We also have, unfortunately, a commercial Chinook hatchery on Vancouver Island that also has been damaged due to the flood. Avtar Dillon and his brother have a 25-acre farm in Abbotsford. You might have been hearing about them recently. They're the folks that have the saffron farm. They've been in the news because they've been growing about 250,000 saffron crocus bulbs. They've tried for the last 5 years to find a method to get it just right, And they were in the news a month ago because they were showing success, and this was going to be their first year. Unfortunately, that's all underwater now, and our hearts are with them. It's devastating. We are closely working with local governments, of course, and the Canadian Food Inspection Agency around the task of disposing and removing animal carcasses lost in the flood. But I'm going to take this moment to talk about a very difficult issue for our producers. There's been a lot of interest by folks around understanding the impacts to the livestock sector. There's been a lot of interest in the numbers and the totals, and I get that. But I think right now it's important to understand that this curiosity that we have about reporting out daily on deceased animals is impacting our livestock producers negatively. Each time we update those numbers, it turns out to be another traumatic moment for our livestock producers. And to tell you the truth, they don't really want to go there right now. They're still in the emergency and dealing with these events. And what the producers are telling me is that they want to focus on the positive moments that are keeping them going. So I won't be updating the animal mortality totals over the next few days out of respect for the livestock producers. They're hurting very deeply, and I appeal to your compassionate side as you address this issue as well. Gary Bars is a dairy farmer in the Valley, and he started moving dairy cattle out on Tuesday and continued to do that. He was able to move approximately 2,000 cows with his truck and his trailer. And today he continues to relocate animals back to their home barns. Has been receding. I talked to him this morning, and he has conveyed the message to me that yes, he has seen some very heartbreaking situations, but he is amazed by the generosity of British Columbians and the donations that are coming in and the positive messages. And so that's what is keeping him going. And so I think that's what we need to keep doing.
A quarter of the Coquihalla Highway may be ruined and in need of rebuilding. Transportation Minister Rob Fleming talked about next steps for the 1986-built link between the Lower Mainland and the interior.
The Coquihalla was heavily damaged by the deluge of these historical rains. All told, about 20 sites have been damaged or washed away, and that is about 130 kilometers of the corridor that is affected. This includes five bridges where spans completely collapsed or were otherwise heavily damaged. And this is going to be a daunting task to get that highway back to being fully operational, but I'm pleased to report that the work has begun right now. We have over 100 pieces of equipment working around the clock to restore temporary access as quickly as possible. We are currently blasting rock at three sites. We are mobilizing equipment to another two sites. We have completed the cleanup at two large debris flow sites on the Coquihalla as well. As it relates to site-specific updates along the Coquihalla, moving from north from Hope to Merritt. At the Jessica Bridge, we are currently installing a temporary bridge while we demolish the span that collapsed. At the Carolyn Bridge, construction access has been built. At the Bottle Top Bridge, we are working on installing a temporary access bridge to get crews across while we demolish the collapsed span there. At the Brody Bridge, we're working to protect the abutments there. At the Murray Flats, we're currently rebuilding lanes at four different sites, and we're also conducting on the Coquihalla in-river work. This is happening at many sites to prevent further erosion and to properly channel the water back under the main spans. In terms of timelines, we're reasonably optimistic that enough temporary repairs can be completed to allow commercial traffic on the corridor in about 2 months' time, by late January. But with that, I do have to caution that the weather will be a factor and a key consideration in determining whether we can reach that target. When we do open up, obviously, like other highways that have been impacted, it won't be business as usual on the Coquihalla. There will be two segments, each 20 to 30 kilometers in length, where the highway will have to have reduced speeds, and only one lane in each direction will be possible.
It is evident that government did not heed expert reports that called for upgrades to bridges and dikes, and they did not act fast enough when Environment Canada delivered weather warnings on November 12th. Weather warning specialist Armel Castellan explained the science behind the wild weather of the fall of 2021.
It is worth noting that atmospheric rivers, and they used to have other names, we used to call them moist conveyor belts, and you might have heard them as a tropical punch or a pineapple express due to where they're coming from. And they've always occurred, right? We get 20, even 30 of them in a given active weather cycle from, you know, mid-October through to the spring. What's interesting is that sometimes we get more potent, longer lasting events, like we saw a couple of years ago and again just a couple of weekends ago. It is fairly extraordinary to have seen this many. Of course, we had a very precocious start to the fall in mid-September, really flipping that switch from the very dry and extraordinarily warm summer that we had, and the impacts there with wildfire and smoke inhalation. And now we're on a streak, and that pattern is very consistent into the coming days and certainly coming week, if not longer. So I think at this point we are, you know, bracing for what will end up being probably a record-breaking fall in terms of overall precipitation numbers for many communities along the central and south coast. You know, the fact that we're going to see more is definitely part of that discussion. And you can look forward to that you can look deeper into the forecast, as in what do we expect with climate change. You know, this event isn't necessarily linked or attributed to climate change, and that would be an academic exercise, but it's super consistent with what we expect going forward. So the frequency of these atmospheric rivers, the bigger ones, the length of time that they stick on the coast and have, you know, that over 48-hour drenching of one particular area on the coast, and also their amplitude as we go deeper into the 21st century. We are going to see stronger atmospheric rivers on our coast, and I think we need to be very much prepared for that signal to be amplified.
Follow thebreaker.news for more on the wild weather of 2021. The fall 2021 session of the BC legislature ended on November 25th. The NDP majority rammed through amendments to the Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Law that will result in a tax being charged on applications for public records. The NDP shut down debate instead of extending the session. As the clock ticked down, BC Liberal MLAs in the committee unsuccessfully made their case for amendments to respect the information rights of British Columbians, including people who lost their homes in wildfires. Here's Caribou Chilcotin BC Liberal MLA Lauren Dirksen.
When questions are not answered, people fill in that information for themselves. And oftentimes when they fill that in, it's wrong. But to the contrary of that, it's information that also may be right, that the government should be hearing as well. And so with respect to this motion, I am definitely in favour of it. The people of Flat Lake had many questions. The people of 100 Mile House had many questions about evacuations when the city was not under an order of evacuation for our long-term care residents that were evacuated anyway. Not once, but twice. The residents of 100 Mile and the South Caribou want to know why so many controlled backburns were allegedly successful, according to BC Wildfire, but that the fire raged for weeks and weeks and weeks. They want to know why fires like Sucker Lake were not addressed and why they were left to burn. These are valid questions. The taxpayers of this province absolutely are owed the answers.
Caribou North, BC Liberal MLA, Coralie Oakes.
Individuals, constituents in my community want to understand what happened in August of 2017. They want to understand when the incident command teams, when there was a changeover and there was a switch, and we had days where there was some confusion. We had some backburns that went extraordinarily bad. We had fires where individuals in Nasco had individual sprinklers on their homes, their own sprinklers that they put on their homes, why those sprinklers were removed, and why, because of removing those sprinklers, they lost everything. And I think it's critically important for us as we try and make things better in the province of British Columbia, as we start looking at increases in climate change and the impacts it has on people and their communities. Information is critical. It's information for working with other ministries. I can share with you, without the appropriate information that is released through Freedom of Information, insurance claims become incredibly troublesome for individuals trying to fight with insurance companies to get the necessary response they need to rebuild. I can share with you, it's difficult for people trying to look at getting permits, whether it's a trapper, whether it's a guide and outfitter, when your territory has been completely burnt out, but you now have to have information to prove why you should be grandfathered for permits and working with other ministries. It's critically important to have that information.
NDP Citizens Services Minister Lisa Bear rejected the amendment.
As far as the amendment goes, I very much appreciate the intent and the spirit with which the member of Kamloops is bringing forward the proposal. And I know the member knows, when I say this, I'm saying this with great sincerity, that we have not yet had a chance, obviously, to assess the impacts of what this proposed amendments would be. There's impacts that would have to be assessed on individuals' privacies, impacts on how it would affect local governments, how it would affect Indigenous governments.
Bill 22 was later passed in the House by a margin of 49 to 24.
Those voting aye: Chander Herbert, Walker, Simons, Papa, Malcolmson, Bear, Mark, Callan, Kang, Baines, Dean, Cullen, Ma, Chow, A. Singh, Russell, Starchuk, Anderson, Bailey, Lohr, Alexis, Routley, Whiteside, Heyman, Conroy, Farnworth, E.B., Dix, Osborne, Fleming, Rankin, Sharma, Routledge, Padden, Sandu, Elmore, Brar, Begg, R. Singh, Deeth, Sims, Green, Chant, Leonard, Coulter, Glumac, Yao, Dykeman, and Mercier, 49. Those voting nay: Letnik, Klovchuk, Wilkinson, Rustad, Kylo, Watt, Dirksen, Merrifield, Kirkpatrick, Shapitka, Banman, Ashton, Kedieu, Helford, Millibar, Bond, Taggart, Stone, Davies, Oakes, Morris, Stewart, Sturdy, and First and Now, 24.
Motion has passed. Members,
Bill number 22, Individual Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Amendment Act 2021, has been read third time and has passed.
On Twitter, Democracy Watch said Premier John Horgan is acting more like an old dictator than a new Democrat. BC Freedom of Information and Privacy Association said congratulations to Horgan and Bear on Bill 22 receiving royal assent. Legislation nobody asked for, that only you supported, that abandoned your prior commitments, and that undermined the work of the special committee. It takes commitment to achieve that. The last question period of the session ended with BC Liberal Interim Leader Shirley Bond pleading with Deputy Premier and Public Safety Minister Mike Farnworth to strike an all-party committee to deal with BC's multiple crises. Farnworth balked at Bond's olive branch.
Mr. Speaker, we began this session asking about how 600 frail elderly British Columbians died in a heat dome. Through an FOI, we discovered the NDP had been warned about the dangers. We've asked about the delays and frustrations the residents of Lytton are feeling as they try to rebuild their lives after a devastating fire. And we hoped that the government would have learned lessons from these tragedies, but then the floods hit and it was clear that many of the same mistakes were being made again. British Columbians expect us to work together at times like this. And that is exactly what both opposition parties asked to do. We can do better, and we must. So will this government commit today to an all-party committee to review and improve British Columbia's emergency response?
Minister of Public Safety.
There is absolutely no doubt that the past 20 months have been more challenging than just about at any other period in the province's history. But if there's one thing that we have seen during that time is British Columbians coming together to get through these challenges, whether it is communities pulling together, whether it's emergency services pulling together, whether it is all of us getting through pandemics, getting through floods, getting through fires, and we will continue to do that.
The leader of the third party and myself months ago said to this government, we want to work with you across party lines. How on earth could that be seen in a negative light? The Premier said that means seeking out, fostering, and championing good ideas regardless of their origin. Look across the aisle. It's time to show British Columbians we can actually do business differently. We can be better together, and we must be. So, to the Deputy Premier, when will the government recognize the importance of sending that message to British Columbians, especially at times like this? Whether it's related to the pathway to reconciliation or to deal with the opioid crisis in British Columbia, we call on the government today, both opposition parties. We want to work across party lines on those two critical issues, as well as look at emergency response. Will the government honour the Premier's words and ensure that we can work together across party lines?
When committees are put together, they are done in the context of a terms of reference, in terms of a project. Honourable Speaker, it's pretty clear. I'm trying to tell them that, yeah, there's opportunities, but what I'm getting is sort of partisan rhetoric back, which tells me that, you know what? This is the last day of this session. There will be opportunities for committees to be struck when we come back to the House in February, and I look forward to it.
The bell ends question period.
The BC Liberals are scheduled to choose a new leader in February 2022.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Mainichi News, AI predicts 370 daily COVID cases in Tokyo at sixth wave peak, but experts urge caution. Japan's nationwide daily COVID-19 counts, which exceeded 25,000 at one point during the fifth wave, were down to just 77 on November 24th, a 99% decrease. On that day, Tokyo recorded 5 cases, the lowest this year. But experts from the Nagoya Institute of Technology are wary the sixth wave will be worse than the fifth. AI predicts increases starting around the end of 2021 due to year-end parties and people returning to their hometowns. Without booster shots, the AI predicts the decline in vaccine effectiveness will mean April 2022 sees infections on a scale equivalent to the fifth wave. In the Taiwan news, Solomon Islands protests continue over China relations. Demonstrators in the capital city were up in arms over the nation's switch in relations from Taipei to Beijing. Protesters set fire to parliament and buildings in the local Chinatown. The prime minister requested help from Australia, which sent 120 soldiers to stop riots. In ABC News Australia, Defense Minister Peter Dutton says China considers Australia a tributary state that should submit to its power. Peter Dutton is warning that China will seize other territories if it succeeds in invading Taiwan. In a speech at the National Press Club, Dutton slammed China for its militarization of the South China Sea, its crackdown on Hong Kong, and the intrusions of Chinese Coast Guard ships into disputed waters of the East China Sea. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Bellingham Herald, 3 bridges are out, but Bellingham saw some success stories as Pineapple Express hit. Whatcom County officials said last week that they expect damages will total $7 million to $10 million from the storm, an atmospheric river that dumped 5.57 inches of rain at Bellingham International Airport over less than 72 hours from November 13th to 15th. Normal monthly rainfall for the entire month of November in Bellingham is 5.2 inches, according to National Weather Service data. In the Merritt Herald, frustration sets in for evacuees in Kamloops. Some residents who were sent to Kamloops claim that they have still not received any assistance since registering with the Emergency Support Services. popular local Facebook group, the Merritt Grapevine, has become inundated with evacuated residents reaching out to share similar stories, noting that they are relying on the kindness of strangers in some cases to provide them with food. City of Kamloops is estimating that they saw up to 3,000 evacuees from Merritt pour into their community. In King 5, crowd questions officials on Whatcom County flooding and response. A crowd gathered in Everson on November 24th for a community meeting about Whatcom County's catastrophic flooding and efforts to help the region recover. Many people asked why federal emergency officials did not rush in to help. Whatcom County's Public Works Director said dredging will not prevent flooding from happening during a major rainfall event like the one the region experienced. Officials told the crowd that money had been set aside to help remove debris and provide temporary housing, but many meeting attendees worry the region will need a lot more help in the coming months. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the farmers of the Fraser Valley, especially those affected by the Sumas Prairie flood. Thank you for growing and supplying British Columbia with the bounty of fruit, vegetables, meat, eggs, and milk. Now is the time for British Columbians to support their farmers in their time of need. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
Vaccine, because once you're dead, then that's a bit too late. I know I'm trying to be funny now, but I'm dead serious about the vaccine. I think we all want to get back to normal, whatever that is, and that would be a great shot in the arm, wouldn't it?
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 28th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on November 28th in 1843, it was Hawaiian Independence Day, or Kalahui, organized by Britain and France? Aloha to listeners in Hawaii. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.